You guys can go ahead and turn with me to Job. We're going to be in Job chapter 8 today as we continue this immense study of this man who was the greatest on the earth, the Lord said of him. Greatest man on the earth of his time, a great man of the East, a man who was upright, who feared the Lord, who turned away from evil. And yet, as a result of an interaction in the throne room of God, found himself on the other end of fierce trials and calamity at the hands ultimately of Satan, but by really the direction and under the authority and sovereignty of God himself. And so this man has been obviously lamenting and suffering and articulating his confusion and his vexation, and has been contending with the difficulties of his ordeal. But what we find as we have been in this new section, or this large section that we stepped into a few weeks ago, we're in this dialogues portion in which you have these three counselors, these three men, these three friends of Job that had come to visit him and initially had come to sit with him, to mourn with him, to just be with him in the midst of his suffering. Now they've entered into a period where they're offering counsel. And what we talked about and what we kind of set the stage for, and really the more I kind of read about this, you find that understanding this backdrop of this theological crisis really helps shape our understanding of the entire thrust of this incredible narrative. What we've talked about is that this section brings this crisis really to the fore. It's a crisis that all of them are undergoing because what was in play in their thinking about the justice of God was what we would just refer to as the retribution principle, retribution theology, retribution doctrine. Really, this matter of understanding God's justice as immediate and linearly retributive. How's that for some 40-cent words for you to throw down? That God's justice, that God brings about justice or just consequences, both in the form of cursings, suffering, judgment, as well as blessing, provision, protection, fruitfulness. He brings those things about directly and immediately in accordance with man's goodness, righteousness, wickedness, failure, sin. Dr. Walton says it this way: the retribution principle is the conviction that the righteous will prosper and the wicked will suffer, both in proportion to their respective righteousness and wickedness. Now, what we've seen kind of emerge from these dialogues is that the corollary to this is that insofar as we begin to observe suffering in the life of another, then what we are seeing is nothing short of God's retributive justice being meted out in the life of that person. That person is only going through what they're going through as a result of some just cause that God has brought about to judge them for sin. So, what's happening here, of course, is that you have these men with this kind of theology, this kind of understanding of God's justice, really consuming their thinking about what they're observing. They're bringing that to bear in their quote-unquote counsel to Job. And of course, Job, as we've seen, is contending with the fact that he too understood God's justice as retributive, much like his three friends. And yet, for the life of him, he cannot figure out nor understand why he is suffering the way he is suffering. There is no, in his understanding or awareness, there is no hidden sin, there is no protracted commitment to wickedness, there is no hypocrisy. Sure, he is a man who is frail. Sure, he is mortal. Sure, he is capable of sinning, of committing sins, and does and did. But in terms of the degree and extent to which he was on the receiving end of this kind of despairing trial, really losing everything short of his very life, he can't figure out why. He is now struggling with the nature of God's justice, the nature of God's purposes in how he works things out in the affairs of men. And of course, his friends can't figure out why Job won't just own up to his sin. So you have this structure, this theological framework, this structure in the minds of these men that is being challenged. If the retribution principle is indeed flawed in some way, then how are we to understand God's justice? Can we even believe anymore that God is just? If, in fact, Job is righteous, as he claims, then our whole framework for understanding God and his acts and works of justice, which flows out of his essence and his character, that comes under assault. That becomes fractured. So all of these men are struggling with this. They're grappling with this principle of God's justice in the form of linear, direct, proportional retribution for sin. And Job is struggling with the fact that he knows of no sin or sins that would warrant this kind of calamity, and yet, what else could it be? And so you hear Job's laments and cries, you hear his anguish, you hear his emotion, you hear him speaking out of both agony and pain and suffering, as well as theological vexation in the midst of all of this. And we noted, as we began to look at these dialogues, we began with the opening speech of Eliphaz. And we saw that Eliphaz was one who essentially began with an air or a sort of a tone of sympathy. Eliphaz kind of represented a profile of a degree of wisdom and genuine sympathy. But we also noted how that counsel that Eliphaz brought to Job initially gradually became more and more compromised because of his commitment to this retribution principle, because he couldn't shake loose the understanding that Job had to have some kind of unconfessed, unrepentant sin in his life. Otherwise, this wouldn't be happening. And Job, the remedy for him is to just confess, just own it. But his disposition toward this was at least a little more sympathetic, a little more seasoned with elements of older man wisdom, if you will. Today, we come to, and of course, we looked at Job's response. We saw how Job was affected by this compromised counsel. And we also looked at how Job, in the second part of his response to Eliphaz, began to lament again and speak and say things in ways that were reflective of his dimmed doctrine, his lack of clarity about who God is and how he works amongst men. So his failure to have clarity about God's justice dimmed his understanding of who God actually is, and therefore caused him to articulate things that were not necessarily reflective of who God actually is. It had an effect on him. It gave him a bleak outlook. His whole perspective of his outlook was just completely bleak. And his faith was beginning to be obscured. His confidence in God's ultimate future blessing, based upon his confidence in God's past revelation and provision, was completely obscured. And we talked about how necessary that is for us. In fact, as you look all throughout Scripture, what you see over and over and over again, the themes that you see, the sort of the injunctions that you see over and over again emerging from the pages of Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament, and almost virtually in every genre of literature that's contained in the Scriptures, you see this constant call for the people of God to remember. There is this constant refrain calling God's people to remember. Remember the works of God. Remember the goodness of God. Remember the kindnesses of God. Remember the nature of God. Remember what God did when this happened. Remember God's works on this occasion. There's this constant call for God's people to remember, especially when either they are drifting into patterns of sin or they are on the receiving end of some kind of suffering or calamity, or they're walking through some kind of trial. There is this call to remember. And so Job, his faith, his confidence, his remembering of God's goodness that was reflective of God's nature, he is beginning to forget. He's beginning to lose hold of that. And so we see this kind of thing emerge in these dialogues as well. Elmer Smick, how's that a name for a theologian? Elmer Smick in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. There's no relation to Elmer in here. I didn't offend anybody with that, did I? And he says this about this whole nature of the counsel that's emerging in this dialogue section. He says, an important lesson to be learned from the book is that counselors must not be sacrosanct. They must be willing to listen, become involved, and have respect for the integrity of the human personality they are trying to help. And they must always bear in mind that they may not fully understand the nature of the case. This is what's happening here. These are men who think that they know what's going on and think that they fully understand the workings of God in the life of Job. And they're counseling out of that kind of certainty. And it's diminishing the effectiveness of their counsel at best and bringing harm to Job in some way at worst. This is the ongoing error of Job's counselors, in other words. These men, as we will continue to work through this, we'll see that they are intractably committed to their theology of retributive justice. And they're firmly convinced that they know why Job is suffering and why he's walking in profound anguish. And this really is the whole point of the book. This is why you have chapters 1 and 2. This is why the reader gets to see from the beginning, well, that's not at all what's going on. That's the whole point that's being made. You cannot presume to know God in all of his operations, in all of his works, in all of his ways. You can't presume to know that and then operate according to that presumed knowledge. Specifically and especially in the context of counseling and trying to bring comfort to someone who's in anguish. The only thing that mystifies Job's counselors is why Job is not responding to and repenting of what is so obvious to them. So in other words, they don't walk with a sense of mystery about the mysterious God that they worship and the hidden counsels of God, the secret ways of God that are obvious, that actually are necessary if we are to believe that his ways are higher than our ways. As far as the heavens are above the earth are his ways and our ways. If we believe that that's who God is, then certainly we're going to have to walk and endure mystery as it relates to God's works and ways. But these guys had no sense of mystery about God and his justice. They were only mystified by Job's lack of faithful response to their counsel for what they knew to be an obvious place of sin that he's just not acknowledging. And this is true of all three of Job's so-called counselors and friends. However, we do see some distinctions in their respective temperaments. And as I said, we began to note some of that in Eliphaz as we looked at his opening round of counsel. And we saw his temperament kind of coming through. A little more of a sympathetic note we saw from Eliphaz in chapters 4 and 5. But now we turn to Bildad in chapter 8, and what we see is someone who is decidedly dogmatic in their tone. You don't have the sympathy and wisdom and somewhat patience and affirmation coming from Bildad. You have dogmatism, certitude, deep, confident conviction that is erring, and the consequences of that error Job suffers under. So let's look at Job chapter 8 and kind of see what Bildad has to say initially. And I read to you, I think, verse 2 a while back as I was trying to contrast Eliphaz's opening remarks to the other two friends, Bildad and Zophar. But you probably, and you may not remember that, but I did read that. But just listen to the tone of Bildad. It says, "Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, 'How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow.'" I don't know if you catch the irony of that statement. We know nothing except that we know everything about you and what you're going through. "Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding? Can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. His confidence is severed, and his trust is a spider's web. He leans against his house, but it does not stand. He lays hold of it, but it does not endure. He is a lush plant before the sun, and his roots spread over the garden. His roots entwine the stone heap. He looks upon a house of stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, 'I have never seen you.' Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring. Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter." In case you're wondering, Job, whom I'm talking about you. "He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more." Here you have Bildad's opening remarks to Job. And what I'd like to do in similar fashion to what we did as we looked at Eliphaz's opening remarks is just to try to draw out some observations from Bildad's statements here that might help us identify possible pitfalls or maybe weaknesses in our own approach to counseling others, particularly as we counsel others who are suffering. Because this really is about them trying to bring to bear some degree of counsel. And I need to mention at the outset that this thread that runs through all of this, that in some ways might make the study and interpretation of this book somewhat difficult, somewhat confusing, is that you have to remember that everything that Bildad says is not erroneous. Bildad is not articulating things about God that are just blasphemous. In fact, there is no shortage of truthful statements, accurate descriptions of God and his works and his power and his ways. So it's not as though we're looking at someone or reading the remarks of someone who are just inclined toward error in every statement and to every degree. What you do see, though, is you see either the misapplication of biblical truth or doctrinal principle or theological perspective, or you see the delivery of truth in a way that is harsh and unhelpful. And mixed in with that, you see statements that are categorically wrong. It's all of that. Which I would say, maybe not in the same manner as Bildad, but I would say that's characteristic of all of our counsel, right? We're fallible. And we don't have constant and pervasive clarity in all matters that we're dealing with and that we're trying to help people through. So let's take a look at some of the some of the characteristics, some of the things we notice in Bildad's speech here that hopefully will help us think carefully about our own approach to counsel, especially, as I said, those who are struggling profoundly as Job was. Notice first here that we see Bildad was defensively direct, and yes, I am going to use alliteration again, but I will acknowledge I did use a thesaurus, so don't think that this is anything but just that. He is defensively direct. In verses 2 through 3 of chapter 8, he says, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right?" So he opens this statement. His opening remarks, he basically essentially calls Job a windbag. That's kind of the pejorative description here. He talks about his words being a great wind. He's just merely saying that he's someone who just speaks with great force and great passion, but it's just empty. Job, you're just like the wind blowing, but there's nothing there. You're just spewing out empty words, and there's no substance or merit to what you're saying. But you notice right away, after that sort of sideways kind of accusation, that undercutting of Job and his credibility for the things that he has said, you notice right away that Bildad is defensive. And he's defensive about what he believes is an assault on the justice of God. Bildad is going to come to the defense of God Almighty and his justice. How dare Job protest his innocence? I mean, his circumstances are the obvious result of God's just punishment. Certainly there is secret sin that he has not repented of. How dare he? How dare he assault the very justice of God in this way? And Bildad's really harsh directness that we see here, in his mind, is completely justified because obviously it is up to him to defend God's justice and protect God's justice from the perversion that Job seems to be enacting. And of course, this necessarily means that Bildad possesses comprehensive clarity about God's just purposes and ways in his dealings with Job. Do you see how that works? We'll see the irony of this in just a moment, but can you see how such a defensive posture can actually only be rooted in one's own pride? When someone is saying things that strike you as theologically inaccurate, why do we think we need to be defensive about that? Does God need to be defended by us, especially when it comes to the very essence of who he is? Is he dependent upon us to defend his integrity? Well, I would say that we're called to speak the truth and to be representatives of God in accuracy and in clarity. But that doesn't mean that we have to be defensive when God's character and integrity is under assault. You see this happening all the time, particularly in various domains of public discourse, where someone may be articulating something about the nature or work of God, the purposes of God, the character of God, that is entirely inaccurate at best, blasphemous at worst, offensive to the sentiments of a faithful believer. And yet, if that faithful believer in turn becomes extremely defensive and then responds out of defensiveness, suddenly now the focus of that discourse becomes, why are you so defensive? What's the problem? What's got you all rattled? And certainly, if you're talking about someone who is an unbeliever, they love that, right? There's nothing better than for a devoted believer to suddenly become defensive. Well, this is what's happening here with Bildad. He is not just exercised over the fact that certainly Job has some area of unrepentant sin. Certainly Job is not acknowledging the obvious fact that he is under the judgment of God for some sin that he just won't own up to. But it's the fact that Job is expressing his own vexation over what he is going through And that those expressions in the mind of Job's counselors, Bildad in particular, is taken as an assault on the very character or essence or nature of God himself. And so, because I know how God works, and because I know that I'm the one to stand in and defend him, I'm going to respond from the jump with offense, with harshness, with a directness. Job never said anything about perverting the justice of God. Job never said anything that would call God's power and purposes and designs into ultimate question. Job merely expressed that he didn't understand why he was suffering under the wrath of God, under the judgment of God. But over and over again, you see Job speaking words of description of God's transcendence, God's power, God's authority, God's rights. And so Bildad is basically responding defensively, and he's not even responding to anything Job actually said. He's just lashing out in this direct and defensive kind of way because he sees himself as the necessary defender of God's justice, of God's character. John Calvin has quite a bit of interesting and insightful things to say about this section here. I'm just going to read somewhat of a lengthy excerpt from him, help us think about this. He says, "We must resolutely maintain the principle that God is by nature just, and that it is no more possible for him to turn from uprightness and equity than it is for him to renounce his very being and cease to be God." In other words, even if Job was actually directly calling into question the very essence of God's justice, it doesn't change one iota God's justice. It has no effect on who God is. Calvin goes on, "God is not a judge like those who are corrupt, like mortal men we see who are elevated in status and authority but often abuse their position. That is not the way God works. Why not? Because he is judge of the world, a position he did not inherit, to which he was not elected by chance, which he did not buy or acquire by skullduggery." That's a great word. "It is his by nature. He is no sooner God than he is judge at the same time. That being true, let us not imagine that he is anything but integrity itself and that his will is sovereignly guided by it. Moreover, as I have said, that integrity, that righteousness cannot be obvious to us so that we can analyze what constitutes it and therefore know why God works the way he does. In fact, he must not be subject to us, and we must not want to subject him to our limitations." Here's the thing. When you're talking about the justice of God, God being just, when you're talking about something that is of fundamental essence in the very character and nature of God, we do not fully understand all the ways that that manifests in the world. And the moment that we begin to assume that we do, what we have suddenly done is we have brought God, because his justice is part of his essence, we have brought God down into our little laboratory. And we began to analyze the very character and essence of God and then extrapolate from our analysis that is fully riddled with our human limitations. We've begun to extrapolate out of that conclusions about what God must be up to, what this actually must mean about what God is actually doing in the affairs of men. And Calvin's saying that's not only is that fundamentally unnecessary, it's ultimately impossible and even dangerous. He goes on, he says, "So if we did not think what he does is good, how would that turn out? What kind of arrogance would that be? Mortal creatures, poor worms of the earth, wanting to compel God to tell them what his works are so they can make pronouncements about them. We must desire the opposite. Even though God hides from us the reason he does what he does, and even though we find his works inexplicable and think we have grounds for making a case against him, we must nonetheless reverence and honor his incomprehensible and secret judgments as we bring all our thoughts into humble subjection and say, it is true that this now seems contrary to all reason, but we will not succeed in our case against God. And then without further resistance, we must adhere to the conclusion that he is just. As a result, because now we only see in part as in a mirror and obscurely, let us await the day when we will be able to contemplate God's glory face to face and understand what is now hidden from us. When you think about counsel, particularly in counseling someone who is going through extreme suffering and agony, if you and I begin to somehow major upon the reasons why specifically they're going through the struggles that they're going through, not incidental consequences of sin that are directly correlated and that are very obvious, but more broadly, a trial, a protracted season of trial, of suffering, and we begin to pontificate on why God is allowing this to happen in their lives specifically, we haven't just stepped outside the bounds of our own limited knowledge. We have actually made a willful decision to assume that we can bring God in his fundamental essence down into an observable space that we can then analyze him and draw these conclusions. It's one thing to speak clearly and directly when we're counseling others. It's an entirely different matter, however, when our counsel is defensive because we arrogantly believe we know and understand all the mysterious ways of God. So much so that we feel that we're called upon to defend them when someone else calls them into question. And that's what we see here from Bildad. His directness is clearly defensive. Well, next, I'd call your attention to the manner in which Bildad is brutally blunt. And that's an understatement. Verse 4. If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. That's just cruel. Your kids basically got what they deserved, clearly, obviously. This is line 2. This is basically statement 2 in Bildad's counsel. Brutally blunt. This is a situation in which obviously Bildad believes that the ends justify the means. Job's resistance to the counsel that he's already received from Eliphaz and that Bildad is now undertaking is an affront to God. And Job's unwillingness to accept this obvious fact of his own sinfulness and the suffering he's receiving because God is just and that's how God's justice works, it justifies, seemingly, in Bildad's mind, this kind of what you might call verbal blunt force trauma. Whatever it takes to get Job's attention is fair game. If I have to be brutally blunt, if I have to go right at a fresh wound because God's justice is at stake, God's character is at stake, I must do this. The ends justify the means. I will be necessarily brutal in my counsel. This is not only just unimaginably cruel, but it's fundamentally wrong. It's presumptuously arrogant for Bildad to think that he knows why Job's children died in a collapsing house when a storm came through. He's not just brutal and harsh and harmful in saying this and using this to kind of make his point. But he's just completely arrogant in thinking that he can make that kind of pronouncement about the ways and workings of God, particularly as it relates to his justice, his execution of justice. Now, in the same way that there are scenarios in counseling where directness is needed, absolutely necessary, there may be situations when we're shepherding someone, when we're discipling someone, when we're counseling someone that might require a measure of what we would refer to as brutal honesty. You know that term? I'm just being brutally honest. No, you're just kind of being brutal. There may be occasions when that's needed. Maybe even rebuke. I mean, there's biblical warrant for us to lovingly rebuke one another, to have the right kind of motivation to want to restore someone, to want to redirect someone toward righteousness and toward godliness. There might be occasions for that. However, I think the obvious strong caution here for us is that those occasions should never be motivated by any kind of self-serving desire to just prove your point. Remember, Bildad has an overarching theological presupposition about the justice of God. That theological presupposition about the justice of God is being, in some ways, assaulted in his mind. Job is not responding to the obvious realities of God's justice in his life, and the subsequent reminders and counsel that he's receiving related to God's justice in his life. He's not understanding the point I'm trying to make now. So I just need to be brutally honest. That is not the occasion for that kind of communication with someone. And not to mention that it was just fundamentally wrong and just totally arrogant for him to say such a thing. Next, notice that Bildad is simplistically sympathetic. That took me a minute to figure out what to say. Simplistically sympathetic. Look at verses 5 to 7. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. So you can kind of hear in this statement a ring of sympathy for Job's situation, in that he is appealing to Job to pursue a certain course of action so that he can be restored to his good place, his place of well-being, his place of health, that he can be restored to an even greater place of blessing. And in fact, that is what ultimately happens. Spoiler alert, that's what happens at the end of the book if you haven't read ahead. But notice that the sympathy that you hear here is sort of shrouded in this, again, this simplistic notion, almost a formulaic, manipulative approach to God. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. Now, what we saw early on in the first two chapters is that it wasn't enough that Satan was given permission to make one pass with Job, remember? And we got to remember that this is happening over some meaningful span of time. It appears like it's happening like in, you know, at 12:04 this happens, and then at 12:15 this happens, and at 12:20 this happens. But these things are happening over some span of time, these calamities. These waves of grief and suffering are happening over some period of time. And we notice from those opening chapters that it wasn't enough. There wasn't satisfaction, if you will, on the part of Satan to just leave it alone at the removal and destruction of all his possessions and resources and the execution, basically, of his family. That wasn't enough. And so God himself granted permission to Satan to go after him physically, only don't take his life. Now, I suspect that Job offered up no shortage of pleading appeals to God Almighty. in the intervening period between the first wave of suffering and loss and the second wave in which his body was stricken with sores from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. So obviously this sympathy is very simplistic. It's offering up some kind of formula for Job if he would just do this. Meanwhile, what has Job been doing but pleading to God for relief? Even if his pleadings included a request that his life be taken from him. Crying out to God and God being silent and the suffering persisting. We don't really help people that much when we come along with our sympathy, but it is riddled with simplistic formulas for how to bring about relief that the one who is suffering so desperately desires. And the reality is that suffering may go on. It may just go on. And we can't be sure of how God might respond to one's pleadings in the particulars. And as we move forward in the book, we'll see maybe why that is and what needs to be the actual expectation. Well, fourthly, notice how Bildad is detrimentally deferential. How do you like that one? You definitely see the thesaurus in that one, I can tell. Detrimental. Chapter 8, verses 8 to 10, he says, "For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding?" So you recall Eliphaz, he made an appeal to a personal vision. I don't know if you recall that, but he had this vision in the night. It was sort of a creepy, scary kind of vision, the way he described it. But in that vision, he was given what he thought was wisdom from God, and he was passing that wisdom on to Job. In this case, you have Bildad deferring, if you will, to the wisdom of the ancients, the wisdom of the fathers. He's calling on Job to listen to, if you're not going to listen to me, if you're not going to listen to Eliphaz, then at least listen to the wisdom of the fathers, those from a bygone age. Consider the fathers and all that they've searched out. And he's pointing to the reality that this kind of retribution principle was not unfamiliar, not uncommon. It was widely understood. It was widely believed. In fact, we talked about this early on, how this idea of linear proportional retribution was a pagan understanding of the gods, right? I mean, that's clear. When you study pantheistic mythology and these kinds of things, what you see is this kind of retributive justice. The gods sort of, they respond to different things, you know, directly and linearly when they see human beings acting in a certain way. There is obviously a capricious nature to it, but nevertheless, it is comprehensive in the annals of time and the annals of history for this kind of retributive justice concept to be propagated generation after generation. And so what he's doing here is he's deferring to this ancient wisdom, he would call it, and say, you need to listen. If you're not going to listen to me, listen to them. Unfortunately, this ancient wisdom is not reflected in the actual nature and work of God and his justice. It's not accurate. It's not reliable. And so his deference to these wise ancients is detrimental for him to appeal to that. It'd be like you and I appealing to some, you know, wiser, older person from church history, if you will, and saying, you know, here's what Martin Luther said about this. I mean, this is why you should do this. I mean, Martin Luther got plenty of things wrong, as does every person who's fallible. So sometimes our deference to sages and even otherwise reliable people from the past can be detrimental if that deference is to their statements or their beliefs or convictions that are inaccurate. Well, finally, and we're just going to have to close with this quickly, but we notice in the sort of concluding verses that He was artfully amiss in his descriptions of how God works. I say that because this last section in verses 11 to 22, it is a using a lot of metaphor and a lot of descriptive language to sort of characterize how the Lord punishes or removes or eliminates those who are wicked, and then ultimately how he blesses those who are faithful. Can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. His confidence is severed, and his trust is a spider's web. Again, another metaphor here. He leans against his house, but it does not stand. He lays hold of it, but it does not endure. If it's like a spider web, certainly it's ornate, it's intricate, it's even beautiful from a certain angle, but it's certainly not reliable. You can't build a house on a spider web. You can't lean against it and have it support you. He speaks of this lush plant before the sun. Before the sun hits it, it spreads out. It looks like it's flourishing and healthy. It entwines around a stone heap, and then it's destroyed. The sun comes out, and it's burned away immediately. This is the joy of his way, the joy of his way, speaking of the one who is wicked, who is sinful, who is hypocritical. And then he says, behold, verse 20, God will not reject a blameless man nor take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more. In all of his flowery language and all of his eloquence, he's still amiss in his counsel. And we might find ourselves speaking to someone, and we need to be mindful of the fact that our grasp of maybe sophisticated concepts or profound theological formulas or whatever it might be, we might be able to woo and wow a counselee with our artful presentation of information. But we need to be cautioned. It doesn't matter if we're amiss, if we're off, if we're not firmly rooted in what is transcendently true, and in the case of this account, we're not firmly rooted in the recognition that there are things about the workings of God that we just don't know. It is not helpful for someone who is older and wiser and maybe eloquent and knowledgeable to spin a narrative about what God must be doing in the life of someone who is suffering, and it sound wonderful and still be wrong. What then? You've got someone who's now doubting themselves. Like Job in this situation, although Job is not a vulnerable person in the relationship, you've got Job hearing these men speak, and he's like, that's just not what's going on. What do I do with all of this artful expression of the principle that even I believed all this time, but it doesn't fit the situation? There needs to be a humility and a reliance upon what is clearly knowable, what is clearly true, and leave our counsel at that. And come alongside people who are hurting and help them get up and put one foot in front of the other. And love them and encourage them. But guard against these pitfalls that we see here in Bildad. And the way that we speak. And the presuppositions we might bring into that counsel that could be wrong. And the ways that we seek to maybe sometimes impress people with our ability to speak well around doctrinal or biblical or theological matters. The ultimate objective is to represent God clearly and accurately insofar as we can know him, and to bring counsel to bear that is fruitful in those ways. Let's pray.